Hey gang, welcome from Believers City Church in Menominee. We are broadcasting live on 101.7 FM, and we're also streaming this service on streetlevelradio.com and jfbelievers.com. So however you're tuning in and joining us this evening, we welcome you. Tonight we're going to rewind or recap our Sunday message titled Samson, A Saved Soul in a Lost Life. We'll be in Judges chapter 16, so if you want to turn there and follow along, that's where we'll be. And so next we're going to take a look at a few clips from that Sunday message, and then we'll discuss briefly the paradox we see in Samson's life, as well as some lessons we can learn and some practical application we can take away from this message this evening. So let's hit the tape.
As we discussed, a month ago, there's few people in history, in the history of the Bible, that it is much had as much going for them as this character Samson. We remember the angel of the Lord that announced his birth, that he was born miraculously of a woman who was barren. That in the womb, before he was born, he was given a Nazirite vow that even his mother had to follow before he was even born, and that he had to follow throughout his entire life. A dedication to God, a consecration to God. It was prophesied of him, again, before he came out of the womb, it was prophesied of him that he would begin to deliver Israel from the hand of the Philistines, from the hand of the enemies of God, whom they were in bondage to. Then we go on to read back in chapter 13 that the child grew and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him. There were high expectations. Perhaps more than any other judge, this judge was endowed with the power of the Holy Spirit. But we see last week that Samson's adult life was anything but consecrated or dedicated to the Lord. Verse 4 and 5 say, afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him, and every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, her name here is Delilah. I came across this in the studies. The word Delal in the Hebrew, Delal, the first part of her name, it literally means to weaken or impoverish. To weaken or impoverish. And that's exactly what unbridled desire and passion will do. It'll weaken us. It'll impoverish us. For Samson, this woman would literally become his kryptonite. Twice before, Samson's desires led him into danger, back as Ben spoke last week and we saw at the beginning of this chapter. Twice before, his desires led him into danger. But this time, this adventure, this would be the last time. This would be the last. Going on in verse 6, we read, so Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and what you may be bound with to afflict you. And then we won't read through it all, but Samson goes through this series. He says to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings, or if they bind me securely with new ropes, or verse 12, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into a web of the loom. Now, if he didn't know she was playing with him the first or second time, by the fourth time, he should have known what was going on at that point. He should have known. And, you know, so do we. Again, the question isn't whether we know, it's what we want. Right? Samson's desire and emotion had blinded him to what was going on. Have you been there? Have you been there? Completely blind to the reality of the situation? All reason, all logic, like out the window because your emotions are so strong? Not even thinking or caring about the consequences or where this is going. I think we all understand a little bit of Samson. Samson's desires led him to a place where he didn't care whether he lived or died. He didn't care. It says she pestered him literally and to the point where he wanted to die. Like, it didn't matter whether he lived or died anymore. That's how bad it got. So he tells her his whole heart. He says, I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. And he goes on and explains the whole thing to her. A Nazarite? I mean, he literally, as he explains it, he's saying, I'm supposed to be consecrated, dedicated, set apart to God from birth. He's telling the enemy this. So picking it up in verse 18, we read, when Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up once more, for he has told me all his heart. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep at her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. So he awoke from his sleep and said, I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Here's Samson, lulled to sleep at the knees of the one who would weaken and impoverish him. Up to this point, Samson had touched a carcass and he kept his strength. He'd gone to a vineyard and he kept his strength. Both of which were a violation of his vow. Perhaps he thought, I got away with it before. I'll get away with it again, just like at other times. What a shock it must have been to find himself there, helpless. No strength. No God to come and rescue him. No one to save the day. Continuing in verse 21, we read, then the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza, and they bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. God used the Philistines here to put out his eyes. Now, keep in mind, these are the same eyes that saw the woman at Timnah that Pastor Ben spoke of last week. These are the same eyes that saw the harlot at Gaza. What does God have to do to get our attention? How far does he have to go? If you are a child of God, how far does he have to go to discipline you? Finishing up, we read the hair on his head began to grow after it had been shaven in verse 22. And then verse 23, now the Lord of the Philistines gathered together to offer this great sacrifice to the God of Dagon. And when their hearts were merry, they said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. So they called for Samson from the prison and he performed for them. And they stationed him between the pillars. Then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. Again, remember those 5 cities. About 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. In verse 28, we read, then Samson called to the Lord, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray. Just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my 2 eyes. And Samson took hold of the 2 middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. Then Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it, so that the dead he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. In verse 22, we read the hair of his head began to grow. And then we read about this prayer. Samson prays and calls upon God. I've been there. Have you been there? Just help, God. Help me. God, anything. Help. Interesting, he uses three terms for God here. You don't see it in the English. He uses the term Elohim, which refers to the triune God of all creation. Not just El, but Elohim. The triune God of all creation, used in Genesis 1:1. He uses the word Adonai, which means Lord, Master, Sovereign One. He uses the term Jehovah. Jehovah is God's personal name. He personally identified with Israel, as to Israel with. Like, I'm your personal God, Jehovah. It's like his name. He gives it to Israel. So personally, Lord, Master, sovereignly, Lord of all creations. Here Samson shows his faith. For once he shows his faith in God, and he called on God and believed that God would hear him. After all he's done. That's some faith. This final act of faith from Samson would be remembered. He, like these many of these other judges, is going to be listed in the New Testament in this chapter called the Hall of Faith. Believe it or not, Samson's there. Like, how did he get there, right? Samson's going to be there, listed next to King David and all these Moses, Abraham, Noah, Samson, in the Hall of Faith as an example. Like, the whole chapter says this is an example for, like, Samson in this moment is an example to be followed. Samson of all people. Hebrews tells us, out of weakness, in this moment he was made strong, and through faith he subdued kingdoms and turned to flight the enemies of God. Jesus tells us in the New Testament, if you try to hang on to life, if you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. And Samson knew what it was like to try to hang on to everything he wanted, and he lost his life. It went down the toilet. But Jesus goes on to say, but if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. And Samson also knew that. He knew at the end of his life what it was like to give up his life and then save it. To redeem it. To redeem a wasted life. A lost life.
Now I'd like to briefly discuss a couple things concerning Samson. First, some spiritual lessons from the paradox that we see in his life. And second, some practical takeaways from this message in Judges 16. When we look at Samson's life, we do see a paradox. He lived a life that was full of self-contradiction, spiritually and morally. But also one that was full of lessons for our lives today. And the first lesson I want to discuss is that a strong start does not always equal a strong finish. Now, I ran cross country in high school, and some guys, when the race started, would sprint out to the front of the pack. You could have 50 to 100 runners. A few guys, they would sprint up to the front of the pack, but often those same guys, a mile or two into the race, would be sputtering. They would be breathing heavily, trying to finish the race, and they'd get past. Now, Samson, he got off to a great start, called by the angel of the Lord from his mother's womb, a miraculous birth from a barren woman. But here, in his teens and 20s, we find that his race began to sputter. He let his eyes, his focus, get distracted by his desires and his lusts. And all the while this was going on, Samson, we read in Judges 15:20, and again at the end of 16, all the while Samson was judging Israel for 20 years. Now, because Samson didn't deal with his inordinate lusts in his 20s, he was still chasing these same elusive desires well into his 30s and 40s. And that's where we get this idea of a saved soul and a lost life. And I want to quote Alan Redpath to you, as he told us, it's desperately possible for a man to be indwelt by the Spirit of God and yet to be dominated by his own nature. He says it's perfectly possible to have Christ and yet live for himself. Perfectly possible for a man to be born of God's Spirit, to be regenerate, to be saved, and yet to live a life on a carnal, useless, defeated level. It's possible to have a saved soul in a wasted life. And that's the paradox that we see in the life of Samson. Samson had not lived up to his expectations. He had not run the race that God had set before him. Does that describe our experience with God? Now, that leads us to the second lesson of this paradox, that in the end, it's only the finish that counts. Again, going back to cross country, the score of the team was tallied this way. You could have 7 runners in the race per school, per team. But the top 5 runners, they would add their finishing position up for a full score. And the team with the lowest score, in other words, the team that had the guys coming in first and third and seventh versus 30th and 40th and 50th, the team with the lowest score would win. So it wasn't based on where they were at in the middle of the race or at the start of the race. It was simply based on where they finished. Now, I think it's kind of interesting because it's a 3-mile race in cross country. And there's some guys who, I swear, in the last 0.1 miles, 3.1 miles, in that last 0.1 miles, they would get a second wind. They would get a kick. And they would pass. Sometimes I'd see them pass 10 to 15 people in that last few hundred yards to the finish to help their team win. See, the old saying goes, it's not where you start, but where you finish, that counts. You know, we all go through the race of life. We all go through times when that finish seems so distant. And we start to feel discouraged. We begin to doubt. And Satan, at that point, our spiritual enemy, he loves to kick us when we're down. He wants to convince us that we're no good. We're too much of a mess. We're too much of a failure. We screwed it up. He likes to tell us that we're finished, that we're washed up, that we are out of the race. Gang, in those times, we need to remember that, as the psalmist says, his hand and how he worked, his miracles and his wonders in our life. And then he says in Hebrews 13:5, I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. Here, we find Samson feeling completely defeated, nearing the end of the race, and he cries out to God. Have you been there? Have you cried out to God? Like David in the Psalms, he said, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right and steadfast spirit within me. In surrendering his life to God, Samson would find that God would give him a second wind, a kick, to finish the race strong. Samson here, in surrendering and losing his life to God, would in the end save it. And we read that out of weakness, he was made strong in Hebrews chapter 11. He finished the race that God had set before him, and miraculously, he did so victoriously. May we look at Samson as an example in this way and do likewise. Now, what are some practical takeaways from this message? Let's get to the nuts and bolts. First, lust and desire, they're like a fire. The more you feed it, the bigger it grows. Now, if you stop feeding that fire, it'll eventually die out to smoldering embers. Most likely the temptation won't be completely extinguished, but it no longer will have the power, the force, the heat that it once did. And you can apply that analogy to sexual sin, to pornography, alcohol abuse, smoking addictions and food addictions, weed, meth, whatever chemical addiction you can think of. And we often think, man, if I just do it once, I can get away with it. Just indulging just this time, it's no big deal. But the problem with that is we can't escape the basic biblical principle that we will reap what we sow. In other words, if we throw another log onto the fire is going to grow. Now, for some of us, that can just be a matter of our eyes, where we are looking, what we are looking at. And I'd encourage you, if that is you, to seek out accountability software like Covenant Eyes that can be installed on your tablet or your phone or your laptop. Having that software allows everybody else that you decide to see what you're looking at on the internet and on apps. It can help extinguish that fire because you're less likely to throw another log on the fire if you know your friend over here is going to see it. And that's what, this idea of making a covenant with our eyes, sometimes it takes practical steps. That's why Job said, I've made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a young woman in that way. And the psalmist tells us, I will set no worthless or wicked thing before my eyes. Samson was not willing to do that. He wasn't willing to deal with sin and to fight it in a practical way. And so he instead tried to operate as close to the fire as he could without getting burned. But I think we know how that went. Now, second, it's normal to have a desire to be with someone. But sometimes we just need some practical help, some guidelines to stay on the course. We need guardrails, so to speak, to keep us on the path from veering off the path. So how can we keep our desires honorable and pure? Now, the Life Application Study Bible commentary tells us this. It says, number one, decide what kind of person you'll love before passion and desire takes over. Is their character, their faith in God, as desirable as their physical appearance? Number two, look for what is truly important in a potential spouse, because most of the time will not be spent having sex. So is their personality, their temperament, and the things they are committed to as gratifying as their kisses? And lastly, number three, be patient, because time often reveals what is beneath a pleasant appearance and an attentive touch. King Solomon warns us, don't awaken love before it's time. And I think these practical helps are useful. I've been married to Faith for now over 19 years, and they've been blessed years. We've been super blessed. I look at the story of Samson. He never had a single week of blessing in marriage. He never knew it. He didn't follow these practical guidelines, and he reaped what he sowed. So what are some practical words of advice I was given? I'm just going to share them with you. Number one, don't spend time alone in your boyfriend or girlfriend's apartment. Number two, don't do anything in private that you wouldn't do in public. Number three, set boundaries and do not cross them, because if you cross a boundary, it's going to be nearly impossible to go back. And number four, this relationship may be your only shot at a godly relationship. If you screw it up, there may not be another chance. These were things I was told, and they may sound harsh, but then again, I've had 19 years of blessed marriage. Would we heed such warnings? A relationship that doesn't heed warnings has little chance of survival and a great potential to destroy us. Now, lastly, none of us have run this race perfectly. So I think many of us struggle with the idea of forgiveness, especially after we've failed monumentally and we feel completely unworthy. But remember, that's exactly what forgiveness is for. Now, let me warn you, and this is taken from a book called Total Forgiveness by R.T. Kendall. Forgiveness is not approval of what has been done, or excusing sin, or denying what happened. It's not a blindness to the wickedness that we have performed. But forgiveness is this: it's being totally aware of the sin and of what happened and what we've done, but choosing to keep no record of wrong and refusing to add any further punishment, and instead showing mercy and grace from the heart without bitterness. See, that is how God deals with us when we surrender to Him. Totally aware of our sin, but He chooses to keep no record of the wrong. The psalmist tells us, as far as the east is from the west, so far has He removed our transgressions from us. And that's exactly what God did for Samson in this story. So as we close, may we consider these practical takeaways. And in so doing, remember the words of Jesus. He says, if you try to hang on to your life, you're going to lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you'll save it. I hope you have a great discussion. We'll see you next time.